This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
New restrictions in Israel today to control the surge of coronavirus infections. Critics say the curfews and other measures are too little, too late.
We are losing very, very precious time, and I can't really understand this behavior of the government.
I'm Marco Werman. Also, wildfires are raging in the West, and we hear from one new voter prioritizing climate change in her ballot decision.
Climate change is just the earth trying to send us signals about, like, all the things that are going wrong.
Also today, downtime in a pandemic. One artist gives stone busts of Roman emperors actual faces. Trajan kind of looks like Nicolas Cage.
Someone said my early depiction of Marcus Aurelius looked like the dude from The Big Lebowski.
Aurelius abides. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Glad you could make it here. We begin the show today in South Africa with an advertisement that has sparked real anger there. It's a hair care ad that many people say is racist. Protests against the company behind it have already forced some of its retail outlets to close. The World's Halima Gikandi starts us off with that story.
Evenus Mafupa decided she was done chemically straightening her hair almost a decade ago. But despite being a black woman in South Africa, that wasn't an easy decision. Back then, embracing your natural curly hair was pretty unpopular. Mafupa says people thought she didn't have the money to straighten her hair with a chemical relaxer or get a weave or wig.
Some people thought I had fallen on hard times and I couldn't afford this relaxer anymore. And a lot of people kept asking me when I was going to do my hair.
But Mafupa kept up with it. She started a now popular blog called Natural Sisters. In her videos, she gives instructions on creating intricate black hairstyles, braids, locks, and twists. Her videos now get thousands of views, and Mafupa gets compliments on her beautiful hair.
Now it's more, you've got beautiful hair, I love your hair, I love your hairstyle. And even when you go out with chunky twists or chunky braids, there's more positive compliments than the negative ones that I was getting.
It's a sign of just how much things have changed when it comes to natural hair in South Africa. This is why Mafupa was so surprised to see an ad that seemed to demean it. The advertisement was posted on the website of Clicks, a major retail chain in South Africa. It pictured a black woman on one side with natural, curly hair that was labeled dry, damaged, frizzy, and dull. And then a white woman with blonde, straight hair, labeled fine, flat, and normal. Mafupa says the ad was hurtful.
Obviously sending the message that Caucasian hair that is straight and bouncy is normal. And then the other hair that you said is damaged obviously is abnormal. And in a country where the blacks are the majority.
The ad sparked an angry reaction on social media and in real life. A political party called the Economic Freedom Fighters said the ad was racist and called for a boycott of Clicks stores. Marshall Dlamini is a party leader.
All of us in the morning were reporting to the nearest Clicks stores to make sure that all Clicks stores in South Africa, they remain closed. Ours is a peaceful protest.
Dozens of stores on Monday were forced to close down by protesters. At least one was set on fire. Today, demonstrations have continued outside Clicks stores across South Africa, including in Pretoria. Clicks has formally apologized for the ad, which they said came from a hair company called Tresemme. CEO Vikesh Ramsunder spoke with a local radio station yesterday.
And we fully understand that the pain and the hurt that this has caused South Africa, you know, particularly our black customers. But there's no way we can condone violence.
I spoke with Ntombenhle Kathwane. She says she doesn't condone any violence either. She's a founder of Afro Botanics, a natural hair and beauty company. In fact, her products are at Clicks stores that are being shut down. But as a black South African, she says she's happy to see people taking a stand.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a black woman first before I'm an entrepreneur. And I must walk the talk.
I have to walk the talk, she says, meaning even if Clicks stores are being closed, Kathwane wants to see more than an apology from the company. She says more black people in South Africa need to be the decision makers in companies like Clicks.
An opportunity for us to take the conversation about racism forward and also take the conversation around economic participation of black people in this economy forward, because this economy is still very much white-owned.
Today, Clicks said it would close all of its stores on Wednesday. It also said it would remove all Tresemme products from the shelves and replace them with local hair care brands. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi.
Considering we're well into the age of enlightenment, it's kind of extraordinary that face masks have become embroiled in the culture wars here in the U.S., but it's not just happening here. A new study looks at anti-maskers in France, and some of the findings may surprise you. Antoine Bristiel is a social scientist at the think tank, the Jean Jaurès Foundation. He's the author of the study and joins us from Paris. According to your findings, which groups of people in France were least likely to wear masks, Antoine?
So it's people who don't believe in what the governments and what the media could say. And it's also surprising to notice that it's people who have really high level of education. So it's not the people that usually mobilize to protest against the government.
So your study's based on a questionnaire of 1,000 people self-reporting mm-hmm. whether they wore masks. So what do we know about the reasons why people said they were not wearing masks? And is there likely to be any self-reporting bias in your survey?
There is two major arguments used by these people. The first one is to say you don't need a mask. It's not really protecting you. Maybe the government in France, which was really hesitating about the obligation to wear a mask, had also an implication in that. The second argument is really linked with conspiracy theories. Because people say the government is just telling us to wear the mask to test if we can accept to be not free anymore.
What does all this say about where the anti-maskers are getting their information from or how they see themselves?
68% of these people inform themselves firstly on social media. And on Facebook groups, you are in cognitive bubbles, into filter bubbles, and then you have only information that fits your previous thinking. So they don't get other arguments which can be opposed to theirs.
So as I said, your study is based on a questionnaire of 1,000 people self-reporting. What can you extrapolate from that about the rest of France? Are you able to compare that number also to statistics
yes.
on people not wearing masks in the U.S.?
Almost 80% of the population, they say, if we have to wear a mask, we will. It's a real minority of people who don't want to wear a mask. But 60% of the anti-mask on Facebook say, the government doesn't have to tell us what to do. We want to be free. And the government interferes too much in our daily life. And it's really similar to a libertarian movement that we have in the US. It's quite new in France because we are not really used to have libertarian movements. But I think it's a phenomenon that is also quite common in the US or in other countries in anti-mask movements.
Why do you think distrust in the French government has grown?
When you look at the 2017 elections, when you look at the first run of the presidential election, 20% of the population who voted for Emmanuel Macron. And nevertheless, Emmanuel Macron has a really high level of power. So a lot of people didn't vote for him, and nevertheless, he is elected for 5 years. I think it's one of the main reasons for the institutional mistrust.
What is the current state of the pandemic in France? Do you know the case numbers right now? And what has life been like lately?
A lot of scientists say that we are at the beginning of a second wave. But nevertheless, a lot of people still don't want to wear a mask to protect themselves and to protect the others.
Antoine Briciel is a social scientist at the Jean Jaurès Foundation, a think tank in Paris. He's the author of the study looking at why people in France are not wearing masks. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For the first time, members of Myanmar's military have openly confessed to slaughtering members of the country's Rohingya Muslim minority. Two soldiers have admitted to killing dozens of civilians in 2017 and burying them in mass graves. The soldiers deserted the military and are now being held at the International Criminal Court in the Netherlands. One of the men, Private Mio Win Toon, said in his video confession that his superiors told him to shoot all you see and all you hear, including children. His actions were part of a scorched earth campaign when Myanmar security forces forced some 750,000 Rohingya from their homes into Bangladesh. Matthew Smith from the Thailand-based human rights group Fortify Rights has analyzed the video confessions. Matthew, these are really stunning to watch. What are the most explosive admissions we hear in these videos?
Both of the soldiers in these filmed confessions admit to killing upwards of 180 civilians between the two of them. That's men, women, and children. Both of these soldiers were operational in two different areas of Northern Rakhine State at the same time. And the fact that they both were given orders to kill all Rohingya or exterminate all Rohingya, essentially they were given orders to commit genocide. And the fact that they were in two separate areas at the same time would indicate some coordination at the higher levels of the Myanmar army. There's also the issue of rape and sexual violence. You know, in one village called Chet Yopin, we knew there was a tremendous amount of rape and sexual violence committed by members of the military against Rohingya. And one of these soldiers, Zong Nang Tun, was operational in Chet Yopin while this rape was taking place. And he confesses to standing guard while superior officers raped several Rohingya women.
You've analyzed his confessions. We can't independently verify they're authentic. Why do you think they're credible?
Essentially, everything that these two men share in the testimonies can be corroborated or already has been corroborated by our previous human rights documentation, as well as the UN fact-finding mission and others. Then these two men appeared on the Bangladesh border, presented themselves to Bangladesh authorities seeking protection, confessing their crimes further.
Yeah, that's also an interesting part of the story, how these confessions happened. They just appeared together on the border at Bangladesh, told their stories, offered names and ranks of 19 of their superiors who say they gave the orders for war crimes. That seems like a really risky move on their part. So why did they do it? Do you know what motivated them?
I want to believe that they were motivated by a desire for justice, by a desire for the truth, and a desire for the Myanmar military to be held accountable for its actions. I think it's also noteworthy that both of these soldiers come from ethnic minority groups. And for a very long time, we've known that some pretty, at times, brutal discrimination takes place within the ranks of the Myanmar military itself.
I mean, I think of Aung San Suu Kyi, Myanmar's most public politician. She's artfully dodged the allegations of genocide. How can the Nobel Peace Prize laureate possibly walk away from this body of testimony?
In many ways, her credibility internationally is shot. She has become a mouthpiece in many ways for the Myanmar military. She's doing the work of the military and denying that these atrocities have taken place.
The Rohingya that you're in touch with, Matthew, how have they reacted to these confession videos?
Many people in the Rohingya community are very hopeful right now. This is a moment that a lot of people for a very long time were telling the Rohingya people this would never happen. A lot of people were dashing the hopes of the community, saying, you know, The Hague is too far away from Myanmar. The military is immune from this type of accountability. And I think today many Rohingya have expressed quite a lot of hope for justice and accountability. I think the people that I'm speaking with, Rohingya in the camps and Rohingya who are in Yangon right now and elsewhere in various countries in the world, they know this isn't a silver bullet. They know this is not the answer, but they do recognize that this is a tremendous blow to Myanmar's denials.
Matthew Smith of the Thailand-based human rights group Fortify Rights. He's analyzed video confessions from two former members of Myanmar's military who say they took part in war crimes against Rohingya Muslims. Matthew, thank you for your time.
Thanks so much, Marco. Appreciate it.
Coming up, climate change and the ballot box. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Throughout this election year, we're bringing you the stories of first-time Latino voters through our series Every 30 Seconds. Almost every 30 seconds, a young Latino in the U.S. turns 18 and becomes eligible to vote. In Washington State, one of those first-time voters is Michelle Aguilar Ramirez.
I feel like climate change is like never been taken serious.
But she's taking it seriously, as are a lot of other young Latinos as they head to the polls. Esme Jimenez from KUOW in Seattle has the story.
Michelle Aguilar Ramirez remembers when she first got interested in climate change. It was in her eighth grade science class.
Someone brought up heat waves, and then they brought up California fires, and it became like a whole debate within the classroom. Some people were saying it exists, other people said that it didn't exist, and other people like me were like, huh? Like, what's that?
Michelle started looking into it, and now as a 17-year-old, about to turn 18 this month, it's galvanized the way she thinks and the way she lives. Michelle started eating less meat. She got her mom and family to use less plastic.
And my mom is always complaining about how, like, the fact that I have all these jars and I don't know what I'm doing with them. I'm Michelle. But then later on, I see her with her little jar, with one of my jars holding her salsa.
She holds up a glass jar that can now hold her makeup brushes. Michelle is not alone. More than half the Gen Z generation, that's teenagers and those in their early 20s, believe that climate change is tied to human activity. That is true even among Gen Z Republicans, and it's having an impact.
They start showing their parents how to recycle. So what we start seeing is a knowledge base that they're starting to teach and engage the parents.
That's Micaela Razo. She works for Latino Community Fund of Washington State, engaging Latinos on environmental justice. Razo says Latinos and communities of color are inherently tied to these issues, whether that's farm workers and poor air quality or pollution in urban areas. They're often the hardest hit by the impacts of climate change. Where she lives in eastern Washington, many of Razo's neighbors have been evacuated due to an ongoing wildfire. And those wildfires are becoming more frequent and more intense.
Right now with the smoke, I'm like, my whole throat burns, my whole nose burns because I'm really allergic to it. It's miserable. You're very miserable.
Last year in 2019, a group of organizations released the Washington Environmental Health Inequities Map. It basically takes environmental hazards and overlays it with social inequities. Then it rates neighborhoods from 1 to 10. 10 is coded in red, meaning a higher environmental risk, while 1 being the lowest is coded in blue. Michelle, the first-time voter, lives in South Seattle. Her neighborhood is a red spot on the map. It's got more low-income people, and it gets a lot of diesel emissions. Razo says she thinks this kind of information will motivate young people.
So we do see a movement more now than we would before. I think I'm starting to see that more youth, more Latinx women are being engaged and are saying this is really affecting us.
Last year, young people and old joined the global climate protest in what is considered the largest worldwide climate action ever. In Seattle, this is what it sounded like.
Rise up, my people, rise up!
Rise up, my people, rise up!
Rise up, my people, rise up!
And Razo says that kind of involvement is important.
We are part of the earth. We have to understand that we're part of the earth in order to heal the earth and heal the things that are in front of us.
Now, young Latina voters like Michelle are getting their families to change their behavior. They're also looking for a candidate that will push policies to invest in clean energy or deal with rising oceans.
Climate change is just the earth trying to send us signals about, like, all the things that are going wrong.
And at least for this Latina, she's still paying attention. For The World, I'm Esme Jimenez in Seattle.
This summer, we've talked a lot about flooding on the show all over the globe. Right now in Sudan, 500,000 people have been affected by unprecedented floods. Heavy rains pushed the Nile more than 50 feet above normal levels. More than 100 people have been killed and thousands of homes destroyed. Marwa Taha El-Haj is a project manager with the Sudan Youth Organization on Climate Change. She spoke with me this afternoon from Khartoum. The flooding has hampered communications there, so the phone line was a bit shaky.
Thousands of people right now are out of their home. There's no shelter. There's no roof over their head. And we expected more.
The Sudanese officials declared a three-month state of emergency because of the flooding. What aid has been provided so far?
Right now, we received aid from Egypt and also Qatar. But right now, all of the national organizations are working for the flood to protect people from snakes and also scorpions.
So along with the floodwaters came snakes and scorpions. The aid, that includes drinking water, food, tents and supplies for building shelter?
Yeah, they need food and they need, drinking water because the water has been contaminated because of the flood. And also there is no places for sleeping. They need sleeping bags, they need nets, they need food also.
So we're in the middle of a global pandemic, Marwa. How much concern is there in Sudan that the flooding could threaten efforts to stop the spread of COVID-19?
Yeah, we expect it right now because of we have IDBs in the western part of Sudan and also the western part of Sudan in Darfur.
Internally displaced people, yeah.
Yeah, had been affected also by the heavy rain. People right now gathering in small places. So we expected the level of coronavirus maybe spread faster than the previous month.
Right. So that is a precarious situation for those people without shelter and now having to live in probably large groups. We can't talk about flooding and not acknowledge the building of a huge dam in the Nile right over the Sudanese border in Ethiopia. I know it's been the subject of a lot of controversy. What do we know, if anything, about how the dam affected this recent flooding?
Yeah, people of Sudan wish because of the new dam in Blue River, they expected that the flood may be organized by this dam. But unfortunately, the river of Nile right now is increasing, not decreasing. But the dam is not what we expected. It's not working as we hoped. So we just hopeless right now here in Sudan.
Marwa, what do you think Sudan should be doing differently or better so the country can deal with the impacts of these floods going forward?
Yeah, I think the whole flood is the impact of climate change. So we have to have an early preparation for this flood because of the people are living in the, near the bank of the Nile. So we need to more awareness to those people to do not build their house very close to Nile, because we don't know. We live in an era of climate change. You cannot expect it what's going on. You cannot predict the future. So we have to prepare ourselves. So I expected our new government to have a good plan for the future.
Marwa Taha El-Haj is a project manager with the Sudan Youth Organization on Climate Change. She's been speaking with us from Khartoum. Marwa, we're wishing you strength as you get through this disaster. All the best to you.
Thank you very much.
You're with the world. Prison sentences have come down for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, but are the right people facing justice?
The people who ordered the killing have never been brought to trial. The only one that have been condemned are the hitmen.
And a new challenge at the Tour de France, COVID testing. Still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World from GBH and PRX. Mentally, let's face it, these are challenging times. If you have contracted COVID, you know it doesn't just affect the body. If you're trying not to get it, it's also taxing our brains. No matter your situation, it's always good to, as the song goes, accentuate the positive. There's less traffic now. We're more motivated to spend quality time outdoors. And we actually have an excuse to engage in time-sucking activities. You know, sourdough, tie-dyeing, slow chess. Toronto-based artist Daniel Vauchart has used his extra time to create photorealistic portraits of 54 Roman emperors. Here's the world's Sarah Birnbaum.
Daniel Vauchart is not a Rome expert. On most days, you'll actually find him on the Starship Discovery. On the television show Star Trek Discovery, he works in the art department making virtual reality walkthroughs of the sets before they're built. For example,
in season two, we built the new Enterprise, so I would take all the digital parts of 8 or 9 people all designing different parts, putting it together, lighting, texturing, and then making like a virtual reality headset walkthrough available for whoever wanted it.
Then COVID-19 happened and Dan was furloughed. And with lots of time on his hands, he decided to learn a new design software. It's called ArtBreeder.
ArtBreeder is a very difficult program to describe.
It uses a type of artificial intelligence.
The main thing that you can do is you can mix two different faces together and sort of get like the if they had a child version of the face.
So here's how it works.
I have uploaded an image of the venerable Marco Werman, and then I'm going to cross it with an image of Marco Polo. Oh my God. I don't even know who this looks like. I would say he kind of looks like a chubby Joey from Friends. And now, if I just slide this toggle right here, I can change the race, his expression.
Anyway, you see how you could lose many hours of your life to this, making it a primo quarantine activity. But back to Daniel Vauchart at home in Toronto. In May, he was in this Reddit group where people were posting pictures they made with ArtBreeder, turning marble busts of Roman emperors into what looked like photos of real people. Dan was hooked.
It's fascinating to see these marble statues brought to life in full color. And it's a strange morph, and it's quite enjoyable.
It was a perfect storm. Dan was out of work, the software is super addictive, and Dan says he's kind of obsessive.
Pretty much my personality at this point is drifting from obsession to obsession. It's just something I've embraced.
In the end, he did 54 emperors in excruciating detail. For each emperor, he started by feeding ArtBreeder different pictures of busts. He came up with a composite image, like my Marco Werman and Marco Polo, but that image was just the color of marble because it was from a bust. So he did a bunch of research to choose things like skin tone and eye color.
There's very few sources on that kind of thing. Most of it is me speculating based off of where the person was born and their sort of family tree.
The portraits are pretty cool. The emperors don't look heroic or epic. They look like regular people with craggy foreheads, receding hairlines, circles under their eyes. Folks email Dan all the time telling him that Nero looks like a football player or an evil Ed Sheeran.
Yeah, I think I've got a list somewhere I could even pull up sort of my favorite comparisons. Otho looks like this. Someone posted a photo of like a fugitive Russian who's living in the Bahamas, and I thought that was a pretty good comparison. Someone said my early depiction of Marcus Aurelius looked like the dude from The Big Lebowski.
Did Marcus Aurelius actually look like the dude? We don't really know. But the truth is, the busts themselves aren't all that trustworthy either. In ancient Rome, sculptures served an ideological purpose. Their traits were supposed to communicate where the rulers were from, or who they were related to, or what they believed in, but not necessarily what they looked like. So Hadrian, for example, is always shown with a beard and long hair. It's to symbolize his attachment to ancient Greece. Did the guy actually have a beard? Beats me. Dan is the first to admit that the images he creates aren't necessarily accurate portrayals.
I get a bit sensitive when people say that, I have somehow realistically depicted them. I think I've just made a realistic-looking face, but I am sure if you time-traveled, you would be very angry at me.
As a matter of fact, the Roman Emperor Project is a lot like building the Starship Enterprise.
I guess there's a similar amount of speculation when you're like 2,000 years in the future and trying to make speculations about 2,000 years in the past.
You do your research, you strive for accuracy, but ultimately, you have to let your imagination take the lead. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Check out that Art Breeder picture of me and that other Marco. It's on Twitter. We're at The World. And you can see Daniel Voschardt's other portraits of Roman emperors on our website. That's theworld.org. Jamal Khashoggi, the Washington Post journalist, was murdered at the Saudi consulate in Turkey in 2018, and now Saudi Arabia has sentenced 8 men to prison for the crime. They will serve between 7 and 20 years. Our next guest calls the sentence a parody of justice. Agnes Callamá is a UN special rapporteur for extrajudicial killings and led an independent investigation of the murder. Madame Callamá, why is this not justice in your view?
Well, the trial has been held since January 2019. It has been held behind closed doors. And most importantly, the people who ordered the killing, including people that were mentioned and named by the prosecutor himself, those people have never been brought to trial. So the only one that have been condemned are the hitmen. The masterminds have walked free, have not even been worried or concerned by the process.
Are you referring to the two senior Saudi officials, Saud al-Qahtani and Ahmed al-Asiri?
I'm referring to them, of course, in the first place, particularly Saud al-Qahtani, because he was mentioned and named by the prosecutor, who in fact reported on a meeting between Saud al-Qahtani and the 15 people who went to kill Jamal in Turkey. During that meeting, Saud al-Qahtani is said to have congratulated the team for the work they were about to do, referred to Jamal Khashoggi as a threat, and to have called on him to be brought back.
So how did the Saudi justice system handle the roles of al-Qahtani and al-Asiri in the case? Where are they now and what are they doing?
That's a good question. They were supposed to have been sacked following the killing, but further investigation by journalists and others has pointed to them still working and operating. So clearly they are not in prison, and clearly they are not paying for what they've done.
And then there's, of course, the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The CIA says it's fairly certain that MBS personally ordered the killing of Khashoggi. MBS has denied that. Should there be a diplomatic price to pay for Saudi Arabia? Like, what do you advise governments to do in reaction to these sentences?
Look, it was clear from the start that we could not rely on Saudi Arabia to deliver justice. So we need, as an international community, to look for alternative tools. And diplomacy is an important one. I think, to a certain extent, MBS has paid a diplomatic price for what is done. There is not one step he can take without the name of Jamal Khashoggi being hammered and being brought back to the international agenda. But more needs to be done. I believe he should be individually sanctioned for his role. And most importantly, the international community needs to do all it can to reveal the truth. And here the U.S. has a key role to play, because the U.S. Congress has asked the Director of National Intelligence to make public the assessment by the CIA. And so far, this has not been done for political reason.
So what can international organizations like your own, the UN, what can it do to hold these people behind the murder accountable?
Look, me, I am an independent expert working for the UN, and I led the independent investigation. So I think that was the first step that was taken a year ago. I think the UN formally should now have a criminal investigation. I did a human rights investigation. We need more to be done on the individual liability of high-level state officials, including Mohammed bin Salman, and that is something that the UN can do. The UN itself could establish a mechanism of investigation of all killings of journalists, because we cannot rely on countries to investigate killings of journalists too often. They will either avoid doing it, there is corruption preventing it from happening, there is no goodwill, there is no political will, or there is no capacity. So the UN can step in along the lines of what I've done, but with more resources and with a greater mandate.
Five of the men were sentenced to 20 years in prison. Do you think they'll serve their full terms?
I doubt. I think given the way the regime operates, the system, I think, cannot afford to have people who work for them to be seen to be punished to such an extent. So I doubt very much that they will serve their sentence. I have to say that they were initially sentenced to death. That was commuted yesterday because of a pardon from the son of Jamal Khashoggi. I certainly support the commutation of their so-called death sentence because, A, it would have been in contravention with international standard, and B, it would have permanently silenced some of the key witnesses. So while they may not serve their full sentence, if I were in their shoes, I will be also quite worried about what may be done to them.
Agnès Callamà, UN Special Rapporteur for Extrajudicial Killings, thank you very much for being with us and talking about these sentences.
Thank you very much.
Summer is almost over. Kids are heading back to school. And in Europe, politicians are back at the Brexit negotiating table. Yes, I said the B word. Brexit is still not over. Britain officially left the European Union earlier this year, but it still hasn't figured out what its trade relationship with Europe is going to look like. And by the sounds of things, the eighth round, yes, number eight of the two parties' trade talks have gotten off to a rather testy start. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry joins us. So the eighth round of talks, Orla, what exactly are they talking about right now or trying to talk about?
Yeah, pretty much what they've been discussing for the previous seven rounds, Marco, but haven't gotten very far. In fact, I heard some commentators saying today they feel like they have gone two steps backward from where they were a little bit earlier this year. These are trade talks, as you say, and the key issues and I guess the key stumbling blocks this time around are fishing rights, fishing quotas and Britain's rights over its fishing waters. And then the second and perhaps bigger stumbling block is state aid, as they describe it, essentially how Britain subsidises UK companies and how it will subsidise UK companies into the future and how that might give British companies an unfair competitive advantage over EU companies in any future trade deals. So this is a big issue for Europe.
Right. So very granular stuff at this point. I mean, the reason I understand the talks didn't get off to a great start, the UK is planning to tear up parts of the withdrawal agreement, which it signed with the EU last year. What is that all about?
Yes, it emerged yesterday that the UK essentially is drawing up its own legislation to deal with issues involving future trade in Northern Ireland. Now, this issue was covered by the withdrawal agreement. The withdrawal agreement was passed by Parliament last year and was signed off between the EU and the UK. But now it has emerged this week that the UK has decided to draw up its own laws to deal with Northern Ireland Protocol. And needless to say, the EU is absolutely furious over this. And I talked to a former UK trade negotiator, David Hennig. He knows a lot about these kind of back and forth negotiations. And he made the point to me that once you break a treaty like this, and he sees the treaty as having been broken, you risk really damaging relations between both sides.
Once you have signed a treaty, you need to implement that. And if you do not, whilst it's actually can be quite difficult to monitor breaches, it is also more difficult once you breach an international treaty to be trusted by other countries. So this is very definitely against the concept of international law to pass domestic legislation and say, actually, we didn't really mean that treaty.
So you alluded to part of the withdrawal treaty dealing with Northern Ireland a moment ago. There had been concerns that if all the I's weren't dotted and the T's crossed properly in the treaty, it could upset the peace process in Northern Ireland. Explain that. And is that still a concern?
In a way, I think there's always concerns of this nature when Northern Ireland is involved. There's a reason Northern Ireland has been the stumbling block in Brexit talks for so long, because there's so much at stake there. And, you know, there was one Irish political party leader yesterday, the leader of the STLP in Northern Ireland, and he said the UK government, by doing this, was risking undermining the Good Friday Agreement, the peace agreement that was drawn up between the UK and Ireland back in 1998. And it jeopardised the UK's own credibility on the world stage by doing something like this. But I put that question to David Tennig and whether he thought the peace process might be jeopardised by any of the talks and shenanigans that have been happening over the last 24, 48 hours.
Immediately, the peace agreement is not in jeopardy in Northern Ireland, but tension is rising. There are people who have a lot of concerns about the UK government neglecting Northern Ireland, not really playing a positive role here, but instead kind of using it in part in a kind of war of words against the EU. So there is a lot of concern that tensions will rise and what risks that may lead to.
So, Orla, will the UK and the EU reach a deal at the end of round eight?
Very unlikely, I think, Marco, by the sense of things today. The temperature is certainly being cranked up on both sides. On a slightly positive note, it's been said that Boris Johnson does want a deal. You know, certainly trade with the EU is really important to the UK, and a lot of people often play that down. But the reality is almost half of UK exports go to the EU. So the EU is a really significant trading partner for the UK, and they could do with maintaining good relations with the EU going into the future.
The World's Orla Barry in London. Thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
From South Africa to the UK and coming up to the Tour de France, today's show, as usual, brings you stories that connect you to the wider world. Continue the connection on social media and share the stories that really stick with you. We're on Twitter at The World. That's where you can find the stories you hear on the show and connect with our journalists who reported them. It feels like every day we say this about a different country. Today, it's Israel facing a new outbreak of coronavirus cases. One of the community's hardest hit is the ultra-Orthodox Jewish minority. Today, the Israeli government announced a week-long nighttime curfew for a few dozen cities. That includes many of the country's ultra-Orthodox communities. The World's Ariel Osaran visited one today, just hours before the first night of curfew went into effect.
Bnei Brak is the most densely populated city in the country. It's not far from Tel Aviv, and it's home to about 200,000 ultra-Orthodox Jews. Bnei Brak has also become one of Israel's worst coronavirus hotspots. People here feel that they're being treated unequally, says 58-year-old Yosef. He's chatting about the curfew with two other gentlemen outside of a religious bookstore. Like most people out and about today, they're all wearing face masks. But many residents here will tell you that the government's numbers are fake, and the infection rate in their city isn't as bad as some say, and that the ultra-Orthodox community is being unfairly singled out. Yosef says he disagrees. He says restricting mass gatherings here, such as weddings, makes sense. But then he asks, what about the big protests against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu? Why is nothing being done to stop them? Because here in Bnei Brak, he says, schools are shut down and religious gatherings are limited to 10 people. Either everything is forbidden or everything is allowed, Yosef says. This is a very sensitive issue here. Last week, Israel's government approved a new plan to try and manage the spread of COVID-19. It's a tier system based on the colors of the traffic light. Red areas have a high infection rate, yellow ones are not as bad, and green zones are good. It's intended to shape the local response to the virus without having to implement a nationwide lockdown. But many say the plan came too late and was poorly conceived. Bnei Brak is a red zone. Like other ultra-Orthodox communities, it has dozens of yeshivas. They're religious schools where hundreds of young men live and study the scriptures. 61-year-old Yerachmiel Moshkovitz is the director of the Yeshiva of Alexander.
The
restrictions that are already in place have really hurt our students, Moshkowitz tells me. He says students at the yeshiva are in a bubble system. They have not been allowed to leave the school in more than a month. The moment one student in the bubble gets infected, it ruins all of our hard work for the entire bubble of 25 students, he says. Then they all have to quarantine, and it's a massive loss of Torah. The term means time wasted for not learning Torah, which many ultra-Orthodox men dedicate their lives to. That concern has led one prominent rabbi to call on yeshivas to stop testing students for COVID-19, simply to keep infection numbers down. Ultra-Orthodox leaders and their political allies have been calling on Israel's health officials, including the head of the country's coronavirus task force, to go easy on emergency measures.
Unfortunately, I don't see the politicians give him the freedom to do what he recommends.
Yael Paran is the head of the infectious disease control unit at the Tel Aviv Sourasky Medical Center. When the first wave of the virus hit, she says the entire country went into lockdown and it worked to stop the spread, even in cities like Bnei Brak. But now, Paran says, there's been a loss of faith in government. People are not complying with the social distancing rules and mask wearing, and the health system is overstretched.
Our hands are full. We are working not in 100% capacity, maybe 300% capacity, and this is a reflection of what's happening outside.
Paran says Israeli political leaders have been squabbling amongst themselves and slow to act.
We are losing very, very precious time, and I can't really understand this behavior of the government.
For now, the newly announced local curfews are set to last for 1 week. If that doesn't slow the spread, health officials say new nationwide restrictions could be necessary. For The World, I'm Ariel Osaran, Bnei Brak.
Cycling fans, your moment came a bit later this summer than usual, but you may now revel in the greatness that is the Tour de France.
Here they go now, 250 meters.
The world's most prestigious cycling competition was delayed because of the coronavirus, but it's now been a glorious 11 days into the tour. On Sunday, cyclists powered 95 miles through one of the most challenging mountain stages in the Pyrenees. The day ended in a sprint finish.
Who gets it? Tadej Pogacar wins the stage.
Tadej Pogacar of Slovenia took that leg of the race in one of those epic finish line battles. Monday was a rest day, with the cyclists and their teams facing a different kind of battle, a COVID test. Each of the 22 teams in the tour has 8 riders as well as support staff, and everyone has to get tested. Mechanics, massage therapists, cooks. If 2 people on any one team test positive for COVID-19, the entire team is out. So far, 4 team staffers tested positive for the virus, but because they're all on different teams, the tour goes on. The Tour de France director is watching from home, though. He also tested positive for the virus. There's one more COVID test before the finish line and athletes are holding their breath.
We all want to get to Champs-Élysées on the 20th of September.
That's Frenchman Julien Alaphilippe referring to the race's famous finish line in Paris on the Champs-Élysées. He's speaking in a video from the pro cycling organization Vélan. Getting to the finish line this year means strict protocols for the riders, interacting only with people in your team's bubble, also washing team jerseys with specific detergent, and limiting contact with fans along the route. No autographs or selfies this summer. Here's German rider Nikias Arendt.
We want to ask you to help us that we make it there. This year we can't get close to you before, during, or after the race.
Riders are practically begging fans to stay 6 feet back and wear masks. But hey, in every crowd, pictures and videos have shown that not all fans are respecting those wishes. Potentially bad news for the riders and the fans. Here's hoping the show goes on. From yellow jerseys to red capes, tomorrow on the world, bullfighting in Spain was already on the decline before the pandemic. Almost half of Spaniards want it banned. Now coronavirus lockdowns could be the final blow.
I really hope that this is the end. We were expecting the end to come sooner or later.
We look at the fate of the nearly $2 billion industry of bullfighting. Join us tomorrow for that story. That'll do it for us today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Check in with us anytime online at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo?
Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.